National politics have put coal in the spotlight. This hour, one former coal miner talks about his work and the misconceptions about coal country. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Nick Mullins is a former coal miner, now author of the blog The Thoughtful Coal Miner. He'll be visiting Iowa, and today I talk with him about the dichotomy between jobs and the environment and the political motivations of mining communities. Before that, I talk with Roger Johnson, president of the National Farmers Union, about the challenges and concerns of the country's smaller-scale farmers. That's all coming up. First, this hour's news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now just over 1 year in office, our new president has taken a dramatically different approach to many policies, including those that impact the agricultural sector. That's why we thought it would be a good opportunity to talk about the ag sector with Roger Johnson. He is president of the National Farmers Union. He joins us from Washington, D.C. today. Welcome, Roger.
Good to be with you, Ben.
Good to be with you. Some, perhaps many, will not be well acquainted with the National Farmers Union. Perhaps you can start off by telling us briefly who you are, what your mission is, who you represent.
Sure. We are the nation's second largest general farm organization. We were founded in 1902, so that makes us the oldest general farm organization. We're founded in Texas, and most of our membership is up and down the Great Plains, Oklahoma, North Dakota, Rocky Mountain. You spread out from the Great Plains. We've got members pretty much in all states, but we're organized in 33 of those states. And we represent family farmers. So as a consequence, we tend to have more members who are small and medium-sized farmers as opposed to the largest commercial size operators. That not to say that we don't have those as well, because we have farmers of all different sizes. And because we're a general farm organization, we represent crop farmers, livestock farmers, conventional farmers, organic farmers, you name it, pretty much everything and anything that is involved in agriculture. We have some of those folks as our members.
Mm-hmm. How are you different than the largest general farm organization in the U.S., the Farm Bureau? Are there ways you can specify?
Sure. Yeah. So our policy is very, very grassroots. It is driven by our members, beginning in the county level and the state level. Those policies move up and are voted on by delegates at each level, and then ultimately at the national convention, where delegates from around the country convene, and they adopt all of our policy. Our policy is it's almost like a Bible, in that we just don't deviate from it. The only exception to us deviating from the policy is our National Board of Directors has that ability to deviate, and they exercise that only rarely. And, you know, if you have a political environment that changes significantly and some of the policy options that our members have advocated for are simply not available, and some sort of a significant compromise might be at hand, that would be an example where the National Board might come in. We are nonpartisan, just like the Farm Bureau is nonpartisan. We tend to lean a little bit to the left of center, whereas Farm Bureau tends to lean pretty much to the right of center. So that might be a big difference.
It sounds like your policy positions are really driven from the bottom up.
They are.
And that's where you take your cues.
It is absolutely where we take our cues. And it's interesting because even though we may lean to the left, there are circumstances where we may be more conservative than the Farm Bureau. And I might offer as an example the last tax bill that just passed. We ended up opposed to it because we were very bothered by the fact that it was going to add $1.5 trillion to the deficit. And our members have adopted very strong sort of pay your bills as you go along the way language. We want budgets that are balanced, and we don't want deep deficit spending. And so that's that might be an example where we would be on opposite sides of where folks might otherwise think we would be.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's keep with the tax, the new tax law. Specifically, you said you were against it as an organization, mm-hmm. But specifically, what impacts do you see it having on the farming community, on your union of mostly family farmers?
Yeah, so most farmers are expected to have at least a modest improvement in their tax situation as a result of this tax legislation. It's interesting because about a week or so after the bill was passed, there was a study that came out of USDA, the ERS, the Economic Research Service, that came to two big conclusions, at least two that I recall. One of them is that the 60 to 70% of all the benefits of the tax bill were going to accrue to the richest 1% of all farmers. So they looked at just agriculture, just farmers and ranchers, 60 to 70% of all the benefits to the top 1%, and the bottom 20% of farmers and ranchers were expected to actually be a little worse off. So it is a tax bill, while it has benefits for most, they're rather modest, and it tends to be skewed very much to the wealthiest among us. Another troubling feature was that the benefits to individuals are temporary, yet the big tax reductions of a 40% reduction from 35 to 21% for corporations was made permanent.
If you just joined us, Roger Johnson, my guest, president of the National Farmers Union. I didn't ask you, how many members do you have?
We've got about 200,000 members scattered around the country.
And a lot of those, good many thousands of those, would be family farmers.
Yes, indeed.
You said you are a nonpartisan organization. You don't then take any position in terms of politics. Do you happen to know the politics? Do you poll the politics of your union members?
Well,
in terms of whether they vote tend to vote Democratic or Republican?
No, we do not poll them. And I know that we have members who are in both parties. In fact, there's an interesting story that I sometimes tell. I grew up in North Dakota, which is a very strong farmers union state. And the word union, by the way, in terms of farmers union, isn't like a labor union. It's more like the word unity. We're a farm general organization, if you will, for farmers and ranchers. But the story that I tell sometimes is about members of our local. We were members of the New Home Farmers Union local, which was a township, an area the size of a township. That's the way Farmers Union was organized in North Dakota, and every township then in the county elected a president who served as the county board, and then, of course, all the county presidents served as the board for the state organization and so forth. But in our township, one of our neighbors, I'll leave their name out just for the sake of the story, but they, very strong, very active farmers union members, and I never really understood the politics of them until I happened to turn 18, and I went to vote for the first time. And there at the polling booth was my mom representing one party and our neighbors representing the other party. And it was just an interesting dynamic, and they were, you know, best friends. But the point of this is we very much are a nonpartisan organization.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We talked about taxes. What are the top issues you and your organization, the National Farmers Union, are concerned with otherwise at the moment?
Well, the big one is probably the Farm Bill. Farm bills are generally 5 years in length. The current Farm Bill expires at the end of September of this year. And so we need a new Farm Bill, a new 5-year Farm Bill. Passing it is likely going to be a challenge, in large part because of the tax bill that passed that added to the deficit. I think you're going to see a heightened focus on members of Congress cutting spending in order to try and reduce the deficit. And this is a time where a farm bill, frankly, needs more money, not less money. Agriculture as an industry is struggling financially right now. Net farm income is 50% of what it was 4 years ago. 4 years ago is when the current farm bill was written, and when income is very low, that's when our members believe that's where a farm bill ought to come in to help. In really two circumstances, either when farmers are faced with disasters or when farmers' natural disasters, drought, hailstorms, et cetera, or when farmers are faced with very poor prices, which is the circumstance we're in right now. One of the dynamics of an agricultural economy is that farm prices, when they are low, they tend to stay low for a long time. When they are high, they tend to go up fairly rapidly and drop fairly rapidly, and they tend not to be at high levels for very long. And then we have these extended periods of low prices. And it is during this period that that we really want a safety net to kick in to sort of help farmers so that they can survive during these low price periods in order to farm on into the future.
What is your view of ag policy under President Trump now after just over a year in office? Is he, in his approach, dramatically different than previous administrations?
Well, I would say two things. Yes, he's dramatically different, certainly with respect to trade, and I'll come back to that in a second. But in terms of his support for other farm kinds of programs, the best indication we have here is what he has done with the budget. Now, he's got one budget that he's proposed. The budget for this coming year is expected in the next week or two. But the first budget that he proposed had very dramatic cuts to farm programs, particularly to crop insurance, where I think the cuts were well over a fourth of the total budget. So we certainly disagreed with that. We weighed in with Congress very heavily in opposition to those cuts. We've pushed back against some of those. And it remains to be seen just how dramatic some of that will be, although the early read that we have is that as Congress passes annual appropriations bills, which they do, they're supposed to do them every year before the new year begins. This year they're on their fourth continuing resolution, meaning they haven't passed a budget for the year that we're in that started last October. They've just passed sort of temporary budgets that will last for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks or something like that.
Let's talk about trade before time gets away from us, if we could. Roger Johnson, president of the National Farmers Union, with me this half hour. Let's talk about trade. Donald Trump, not a fan of NAFTA. Candidate Trump promised to renegotiate NAFTA, the North America Free Trade Agreement. Now those talks are happening. Already has pulled out of the what was forming the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. Give us your view on trade, because, of course, that certainly affects commodity prices and how well farmers do, given that so many of our of what is grown here in the United States cattle and so forth goes overseas to be consumed.
So the first thing I would say about President Trump and his trade policies is that we don't disagree with the president in terms of what he professes to believe in terms of trade policy. And the big issue that he has raised consistently has been the trade deficit. And we agree with him that the trade deficit needs to be dealt with. In agriculture, we have a trade surplus. That's a good thing. That means we sell more stuff to other countries than we buy from them. That creates economic activities and jobs in this country. Unfortunately, the agricultural trade surplus is about 4% of the overall trade deficit. The trade deficit's over $500 billion a year. That's millions of jobs that are lost, and it's about a 3% drag on our economic growth in this country. So he's right to focus on the trade deficit. He's right to say that our dispute resolution system needs to be fixed in these trade agreements and to renegotiate these agreements. Where we would disagree with the president is in his approach, in his tactics. I don't think it is a good negotiating tactic to offend your trading partners before you ask them to sit down and talk about how you can negotiate a deal that's better for the both of us. And that's something that I think has done a lot of damage to agriculture. I mean, the Mexicans have already been buying corn from the Southern Hemisphere, not because it's cheaper, it isn't, but because they want to diversify the business that they have with the United States. They're offended by how this president has treated them, and that's having an impact on agricultural income.
Mm-hmm. As I said, NAFTA being negotiated, I think it was just the other day, Prime Minister Trudeau of Canada said he was willing to walk away from a deal that he didn't like. Certainly Donald Trump has voiced that. What would be the impact on farming here in the U.S. of pulling out of NAFTA, our agreement with Canada, our friends to the north and the south, and Mexico?
Yeah, I think the impact would be pretty dramatic, and it would be traumatic. I think there are a lot of relationships, business relationships that have been structured over these last 25 plus years since NAFTA went into effect that would be severed very rapidly. I think you'd see a lot of disruption, a little bit of disruption in agriculture, and you see markets react pretty profoundly. So I think you'd see a deep drop in market prices for grains and for livestock. It would not be good. It would be very, very disruptive. And again, I would say there are ways that NAFTA can and should be renegotiated. But to simply to keep threatening to pull out as you continue to offend your trading partners strikes me as not being the best way to negotiate a new NAFTA.
Roger Johnson, with the president of the National Farmers Union. We have a few more minutes I'd like to devote to farm health and farmers' health. I see statistics. I'm not how well you keep up on these, but in looking at statistics in terms of mental health of farmers, not altogether good. In 2012, suicides among those working in farming, fishing, and forestry were higher than any other group of careers. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. In fact, it's almost, well, it's probably 40% higher than the next highest group, which is in construction.
Why is that?
Well, there's probably a lot of reasons, but certainly the financial stress has got to be a huge part of it right now. There's just a lot of stress in agriculture. USDA projects that this year net farm income will be negative for more than half of the farmers and ranchers in the country, meaning half of our farmers will make a dollar or more, and a half or more will lose money on the farm. They won't even be able to make a dollar to put food on the table, to provide family living, etc. So that the financial stress is a big, big factor. And then you've got other factors. You know, farming tends to be a more solitary kind of occupation than a lot of other ones. There may be less interaction with other folks. So you've got the financial stress, the economic stress. You may have some social isolation that's right. involved. There's another factor that may well be contributing in some way, and that's the opioid crisis right now, which we know to be a much larger issue for farmers than it is in the rest of rural America, and a much larger issue in rural America than it is in urban America. And that's a dramatic statement, what I just said there. And most folks who have an opioid addiction, some 80% of them got that way by using legally prescribed drugs.
Right.
So you know, you add all these things together, and it creates a lot of stress.
Right.
And
you just described the problem. We have a couple minutes left. What's the solution to poor farmer health? Poor farmer mental health.
Well, I think there are a few things. I did a day and a half seminar up in North Dakota last week, actually, on this question, where there are a number of folks that weighed in on it. First of all, awareness. You have got to increase awareness of the issue. Secondly, you have to talk to folks. You know, farmers, as I mentioned earlier, they tend to be somewhat more isolated. When they get depressed, there aren't as many people interacting with them, and those that do interact may not recognize the signs of depression. So we've got to do more to educate the rest of us about what are the signs of depression. Certainly when somebody talks about it, makes statements like, oh, maybe I'd be better off if I just weren't here and the family would be better off. They'd get insurance, blah, 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 that kind of stuff. That's something that is to be taken deadly seriously. Folks don't just say that unless they're thinking that.
Mm-hmm.
And so awareness is the big thing. And that's, you know, one of the places where Farmers Union and Farm Bureau have gotten together is trying to bring heightened awareness to the opioid crisis in rural America. And it's a good example of places where, you know, in a lot of ways, farm organizations tend to work together rather than at odds out in D.C. And this is a perfect example of one of those cases where we just want to raise awareness, because until you raise awareness, it's unlikely that you're going to get the right kind of a policy solution to a problem.
Okay. Joining us from Washington, D.C., Roger Johnson, president of the National Farmers Union. Roger, thank you so much for your time and your insights.
Good to be with you, Ben. Take care.
When we come back, I'll talk with Nick Mullins, a former coal miner, now author of the blog The Thoughtful Coal Miner, and I bet he'll explode some misconceptions you have about people in coal country. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Why would someone from coal country come to corn country to give a public talk? Well, we're about to find out. My guest this half hour is Nick Mullins. He's a former coal miner and author now of the blog The Thoughtful Coal Miner. He'll be speaking at Iowa State University in a presentation called Coal, Climate, and Environmental Backlash, Monday, February 19th. He joins me now. Hi, Nick Mullins.
Hi, how are we doing?
I'm doing fine. You've been touring around the country talking, giving talks. What is the message you have for Iowans? What do you want us to know about southwestern Virginia, where you grew up?
Well, I'd like for people to know that we're not exactly what people make us out to be in a lot of times in the national media, especially in relation to the presidential election a couple of years ago. So we have a lot of history, and we have a lot of issues that we have to address, and that, a lot of times our political choices, they're influenced by economics.
Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about the popular conception, the common conception that people have Americans have of your area and the people who live there. Well, what do you run across as far as myths and stereotypes?
Well, I mean, of course, we've had the long-held stereotypes of the hillbilly stereotype. You know, people think that we're ignorant, that we're backwards, movies come to mind such as Deliverance from the 1970s and programs on national television like Buck Wild on MTV. I think everybody just thinks that we're very rural, deplorably so, to use the words of one presidential candidate. And also that we are coal industry loyalists. I think that's really kind of come across in the past 10 to 15 years, due to the, issues of climate change and people holding out for the industry. That's pretty much our only industry within the area.
Mm-hmm. Coal industry loyalists. Tell us why that isn't the case.
Well, I think a lot of it is that people think of us as coal industry loyalists from a lot of the counter protesting that people do to environmental protesting in the area. We're seeing images of coal miners on television with President Trump and through his promises that he'll bring the coal industry back. And of course, there's a lot of people out there who do speak out positively about the coal industry and the necessity of coal mining for jobs. And I think that has really kind of been what the national media has focused in on whenever they talk about Appalachia. But in reality, it is just an economic necessity. And it's really counterbalanced with this environmental movement that started in the early 2000s.
So an economic necessity for Appalachia, that region, to have coal mines. You were a coal miner. This is how you grew up. This is, as you state at the top of your blog, five generations of your family have been coal miners?
That's correct. Yeah, I was the fifth generation. My father, both my grandfathers, my great-grandfather, and my great-great-grandfather were coal miners. But this wasn't something that they did necessarily out of just pure choice. They didn't really want to be coal miners. It was just the only option in the area. And that began around the late 19th century, early 20th century, whenever the land agents would come into the areas and they purchased up all of our mineral rights and sometimes outright swindling them from us. So the extractive industries, they became our only choice to live in an economy.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, how many years did you mine coal?
I myself avoided it for the majority of my young adult life, but I ended up going in 2007, and I stayed until 2010. The unions were gone, and things weren't quite as well in the mining industry as far as employee safety and hours and so on and so forth as they had been during the union days.
Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of what coal mining is like these days.
Well, it's definitely there's a big push for production. That's always been there, but nowadays people are they're fighting over each other to make sure that they get the production number sent down by the company. And whenever they do that, people end up competing with each other to make sure that they're not the next ones that are laid off whenever the coal markets, they go down and mines are shut down. So, I mean, it's long hours, mandatory overtime. You're working in conditions that are just, sometimes run at breakneck speeds in order to get as much coal down or out of the ground as possible.
What function did you perform?
I started out as an equipment operator. I run a shuttle car and a roof boulder, but then I went into electrical repair, and so I was actually an equipment repairman underground.
So this is all underground coal mining?
Yes, I was underground, so were all my forefathers. There's also surface mining in the area, especially like mountaintop removal, but that is extremely detrimental to the surface streams and forests, and I just couldn't bring myself to get involved with that. Not after seeing how much had happened around my own home and seeing what it had done to everything.
How widespread are safety concerns in the industry among the workers?
Well, I mean, it's one of those things that, you want to be safe. You try to be as safe as possible, but at the end of the day, you've got to take care of yourself and your family, and, people don't do things that are extremely risky. But it just depends on the situation. I think that a lot of the time people are just trying to do their work, and they're not going to do anything completely ridiculous to get themselves in a bad situation. But sometimes people do take shortcuts to increase production, and they might work in a dustier condition without a mask than they really should. They might work with a piece of equipment that isn't completely up to par as far as all the safety on it. But rather than shut down the machinery and wait for the dust to clear, or rather than wait for it to be repaired, they don't want to be caught with downtime and having been the one to reduce production for the section for that particular time period.
Nick, can you make a good living as a coal miner?
You can make a really good living, yeah. The last full year that I worked, I made $72,000. I mean, you can make a lot of money, especially in a region that is economically depressed, that has, the subsequent lower cost of living. So you can make a really good living at it and earn a lot of money, but there's just not the job security that you would have with other industries. With the coal markets up and down, competition coming in from natural gas and all sorts of other things causing market fluctuations, you just never know how long your job's going to last.
Nick Mullins is my guest this half hour, former coal miner, as you've just heard. He's the author of the blog The Thoughtful Coal Miner. He'll be speaking at Iowa State University on Monday, February 19th. Of course, President Trump, a big supporter during his campaign, also during his presidency, of coal country in his recent State of the Union address. To quote the president, "We have ended the war on American energy. We have ended the war on beautiful, clean coal. We are now very proudly an exporter of energy to the world." So talk a little bit about this idea of clean coal. It's a really a PR term that refers to coal pollution mitigation. The idea of whether coal can be clean is hotly debated. Where do you stand on this?
Well, there's no such thing as clean coal. I mean, there might be ways to mitigate some of the pollution that goes in the air. I mean, I grew up hearing about acid rain and how they were able to finally put in scrubber systems to eliminate the sulfur dioxides coming out of smokestacks. But the truth is no matter how clean that you can make it as at the end use process, whenever you're actually mining the coal, you're leaving behind wastes. You're creating environmental damage that cannot be repaired, whether it be surface or underground. Mining impacts local, water infrastructure. It affects aquifers. It affects the flora and fauna. So whenever you strip all that away in surface mining, you're not leaving anything behind. You're not leaving the natural ecosystems behind. Plus, by disturbing the mountains, disturbing all the strata, you're actually mixing and introducing various heavy metals into the soils that then filter out and leach out over time. So that's the reason areas of Appalachia have increases of things like arsenic in their water, as minerals like selenium, mercury, as another heavy metal. And there's a lot of acidic mine drainage as well. You know, in the 1960s, there was a underground mine that ruptured. It had acidic mine drainage in it with a pH level of 2, which was pretty much sulfuric acid at that point. So all of this damage, you know, impacts the regions where coal is extracted, so it can't ever be clean, you know, in terms of the communities who have to deal with the extraction.
Is that a view that is widely held in the region where you grew up in Virginia?
Well, I think people, it depends on the person. I didn't think about it that much the entire time that I was there. You just become used to it. You see it, but you don't really think about it. You know, and you realize too that you need to have a job. You need to work to be able to provide for your family. And there's very few jobs in the area that provide a living wage. That's why coal is pretty much the mono economy there. So you don't really think too deeply about it. You just see it and go on. There are some people, though, that do see it the way, you know, that a lot of us do, understand the problems with it, but they're reluctant to speak out on it because they don't want to, you know, cause any issues within the area. The other side of it is that a lot of environmental activists have, you know, descended into the area over the past 15 years surrounding mountaintop removal, and they've kind of brought in a culture and an understanding that has grated against some people's own culture in the region, harking back to those stereotypes to some degree that people have suffered from outside individuals coming in to try to help us and things of that nature. So the whole idea that there's a problem with the environment was wrapped up in the environmental movement, and people have a little bit of a distrust of that. And that can get really complicated really quick whenever you start speaking in terms of the rural-urban divides, liberal versus conservative, and some cases religion.
Of course, the presidency, the campaign, and the presidency of Donald Trump really put a focus on coal country. But also, J.D. Vance, an author who has become New York Times best-selling author with his book Hillbilly Elegy, has to a large degree sort of made it clear to the rest of the country what he thinks the culture is of Appalachia, coal country. In fact, I saw recently, I don't know if this is going to happen, but he was been asked to run for a seat in Ohio, I believe. What do you view? I've read the book, Hillbilly Elegy. I imagine you have too. What do you think of the character he gives coal country in his book?
An extremely shallow character is what I think about it. You know, I read the book as well, like you said, and the problem is that J.D. Vance really didn't take time to understand and research the contextual issues that people in Appalachia have faced. And this is a problem that we have seen for half a decade or better. People want to focus in and try to blame Appalachia's issues and problems on a pathological culture. You know, we should be able to pick ourselves up by our own bootstraps. We should be able to take care of ourselves. And it's just a matter of, you know, our being unable to find work ethic within ourselves. That's the kind of message that I really got from J.D. Vance. But the truth is, people don't have choices. You know, the public education system in the coal fields is very underfunded. There's such outside land ownership from outside land holding companies that it makes developing an economy difficult, as well as continuing to have a tax base able to fund public education. I mean, in Kentucky just passed a bill that reduced the taxes on unmined minerals. So that was a huge input of tax funds from coal companies who own mineral rights into the local budgets. And since they reduced that tax, the schools are now in panic mode. They can't fund themselves. So you've got a problem with education, you know, lack of public funds for that. You have a predominant industry, very few other industries in there. people just don't have options and choices. So, you know, and this is a historical problem with Appalachia. And it began again whenever landholding companies came in and purchased up everybody's mineral rights. And they started building coal company towns and exploiting labor for mining and the timber industry. So these are all things that have played into this issue. Unfortunately, Mr. Vance, as much as he wants to claim hillbilly status, he didn't grow up in the Appalachian Mountains. He grew up as the grandson of somebody who left the mountains, in their teens. So he doesn't have a lot of credibility there, and it really comes through whenever you read his book and see how much he lacks the understanding of the region.
Mm-hmm. What's it been like in coal country since the presidency of Donald Trump started just over a year? Donald Trump, in recent days, has enjoyed a slight bump in favorability nationwide since his State of the Union address, still lingers at historic lows for presidents at this time in their presidency. What is the opinion of President Trump in coal country, where you grew up?
I think there's a lot of mixed feelings. What I've seen is there have been some slight upticks in coal production that have created a few more jobs, but nothing to the level that we need to really restore the economy of Appalachia, even to what it was in the 80s, 70s and 80s, and those were tough times even when the coal industry was running full tilt.
Do people in the area expect there to be a greater uptick in the economy because of new policies? I'm hearing economists also saying this is just the way of the future toward renewable energies, and that coal has really seen its day.
And I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, we've looked, looking back, we have seen a tremendous decrease in employment in the coal industry. And that is because of mechanization, of course. Mining has continuously been mechanized to a point to where we don't need as many people to do jobs like on surface mining with heavy equipment, underground with continuous mining machines and equipment. Also, there's just not as much coal left as there once was. I mean, the coal reserves of Appalachia are nearing depletion. I mean, what's there, what recoverable seams are there, are harder to get to and more difficult to mine because they're deeper in the ground. There's more methane gas at those levels. And, surface mining is extremely detrimental to the surface. So it's everything that's kind of pushing coal away is rooted right there in the region itself. But also we have to look at renewables. We do have to look at the natural gas industry and how that's also shoving coal out of the market. So Appalachia never was a great boon for in terms of economics whenever it came to the coal industry. It's always been an extractive industry. It's always been a natural resource curse for the area, and it's just going to continue to decline. All that we can do is maybe find short reprieves in the boom and bust cycle, and that's occurred at least twice in my lifetime, and see small upticks in employment. But overall, we need something completely different. We need an overhaul of our entire economy in the region.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, Nick Mullins, as a former coal miner, you are coming from coal country to speak in corn country, as I mentioned. Roughly 40% of the nation's corn is used to create biofuels, ethanol. Iowa is the number one producer of corn. So this is really an interesting mix that you're coming to a very different facet of the energy picture in the United States to visit and give this talk.
Yes, certainly. I mean, we have to be looking at all sorts of alternative energies throughout the nation and the world. Ethanol production is one of those things that can be definitely a tool in it. Biofuels is definitely something that we need to look at, but even more so, I think across the nation, we need to look at energy efficiency as our first fuel, as some people have coined it. We're just wasting too much, and once we can kind of get that under wrap, we can hopefully start looking and really investing in these others as well.
Mm-hmm. And Nick Mullins, to finish up here, you started by describing how there are myths and misconceptions about people from the area you grew up in, southwestern Virginia, coal country. Tell us, in closing, what do people in the area you grew up, think about Iowa and Iowans. What cliches would I run into, would I hear, if I heard some candid opinions about the people here?
I don't know. I think, I mean, you know, I can't speak for everybody.
It's okay. It's okay. We can take it, Nick. You can give it to us. It isn't anything we haven't heard before, I'm sure.
Honestly, you know, perceptions of the Midwest and places like Iowa is farm country, farmers, people who are trying to make a living the best way they can by, from the earth. We grew up, seeing about farm aid, and whenever I was a kid in the 80s, we saw that, it being union, we also understood that there was a lot of forces out there that were hurting all America's working class, including the farmers. So there was a lot of people that felt deeply about people who were just trying to make a living, supplying the food of the nation. So that's, I don't think we had any real stereotypes or anything outside of that of the region. Just more hardworking people, blue collar people trying to do what was best for their families. And we kind of could all relate to that in one way or another.
Okay. Nick Mullins, former coal miner, author of the blog, The Thoughtful Coal Miner. He'll be speaking at Iowa State University on Monday, February 19th. Nick Mullins, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. And we look forward to welcoming you here to Iowa.
Thank you, and look forward to being there.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Ben Stanton. Help today also from Lulu Dewey. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. Hope you'll join us for our News Buzz edition of the program tomorrow. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Hit the coal miner boogie, and you boogie woogie all night long.